Okay, here we go. Where the hell did I put my intro thing? Oh, that's right. I don't have any intro text this time. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening, or morning, or whatever time it happens to be where you are when you decide to start listening to this. And welcome to Rangers America, Episode 17. I am your host, Zeno Valent. With me is my lovely and talented co-host, Gret.
Hello.
How are you today, Gret?
Tired.
And how is your project nomming with Gret coming along?
Slow. We typically record on Sundays, but I've been scheduled to work the past few Sundays, so we haven't exactly gotten around to it.
Okay. Well, hopefully you'll get some more media out for us to watch soon.
Hopefully we're going to do it tonight once we're done with Rangers America.
That would be awesome. Okay. We did not receive any feedback on the last show. I do appreciate it if we get feedback, so either leave comments on the Rangers.com website or send me email at zenovalent@aim.com, and you will get your opinions known, as well as the opinions of the hosts. Okay, and with that said, let's jump straight into the news stories. And I believe you were going to take the first one, Gret?
Sure. Our first story, Meghan McCain, Tea Party represents innate racism. Young people turned off by Tea Party movement, racist undertones, McCain says. The daughter of former presidential candidate John McCain has sharply criticized the Tea Party movement, accusing it of innate racism. In an appearance on ABC's The View, Meghan McCain also took issue with a number of recent statements from Sarah Palin, criticizing the former Alaska governor for defending Rush Limbaugh's use of the word retard, and for suggesting that President Obama launch a war against Iran in order to win a second term. McCain described former Republican Congressman Tom Tancredo's call for a literacy test for voters as innate racism. In his opening speech to the Tea Party convention last week, Tancredo urged the creation of literacy tests for voters, a move some observers likened to a return to the Jim Crow laws of the pre-Civil Rights Act era. People who would not even spell the word vote or say it in English put a committed socialist ideologue in the White House named Barack Hussein Obama, Tancredo told the Tea Party crowd. It's innate racism, and I think it's why young people are turned off by this movement, McCain reported on The View. I'm sorry, but revolutions start with young people, not 65-year-old people talking about literacy tests and people who can't say the word vote in English, McCain added. McCain, a self-described progressive Republican, criticized Palin's assertion that President Obama could get himself reelected to a second term if he launched a war against Iran. You should never go to war unless it's the absolute last circumstance, McCain said. As for Palin's defense of Rush Limbaugh using the word retard after calling for White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel's resignation over the same word last week, and said it was a symbol of exactly what is wrong with politics today. We can't placate and say Democrats can say one thing and Republicans can say another thing, she said. McCain added that the rhetoric coming from the Tea Party movement and from Republicans like Palin will continue to turn off young voters, and anybody who says different is smoking something. I like that last sentence.
Yeah, she just implied that the leaders of the Tea Party were smoking marijuana.
I like it. Maybe it would mellow him out.
I think I like Meghan McCain. She's a lot more level-headed than most of the people who get involved in the political scene today.
Yeah, I definitely like her too. I like a lot of the work she's done and a lot of the causes that she fights for. I like how her mom is getting more involved with it too. It's kind of like a big middle finger to the Republicans who aren't exactly open-minded.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anything else we want to say on that one?
Kind of. I don't know enough about the Tea Party other than I agree with the stuff she said. It is full of innate racism, and they're just, they lie about a lot of the stuff that they say. And what's worse is when they have these Tea Party rallies that they've been having more and more of, they get their kids involved. And someone who, you know, if you see toddlers holding a sign saying, "Who's going to pay for my future?" and the kid can't even read, that's sickening to me. But okay. That's really all I've got to say about that.
Sure. I did notice on the internet earlier today, I believe it was Rachel Maddow, was on some TV show or something and was actually pointing out all the places where it wasn't the Tea Party, it was some conservative political action conference that's going on right now, was mm-hmm. pointing out all the spots where the speakers got things that were just dead wrong.
Yeah.
Which was pretty amusing.
I saw that too. I saw that. I also saw a video clip of her ripping Glenn Beck a new one because he called Bill Nye, the science guy, a liar.
Okay. It's hard to lie about science, though.
I know.
Because, well, the whole point of the scientific method is you can do repeatable to get experiments.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to the next story. Trial begins for activist who fought to protect federal lands from drilling. Join the protest. Tim DeChristopher is facing 10 years in jail for a profound gesture made on behalf of all of us and our future. It's time to show our solidarity with him. Dear friends, the epic fight to ward off global warming and transform the energy system that is the core of our planet's economy takes many forms. Huge global days of action, giant international conferences like the one that just failed in Copenhagen, small gestures in the homes of countless people. But there are a few signal moments, and one comes next month when the federal government puts Tim DeChristopher on trial in Salt Lake City. Tim, bitter 70, pulled off one of the most creative protests against our runaway energy policy in years. He bid for the oil and gas leases on several parcels of federal land, even though he had no money to pay for them, thus upending the auction. The government calls that violating the Federal Onshore Oil and Gas Leasing Reform Act and thinks he should spend 10 years in jail for the crime. We call it a noble act, a profound gesture made on behalf of all of us and of the future. Tim's action drew national attention to the fact that the Bush administration spent its dying days in office handing out a last round of favors to the oil and gas industry. After investigating irregularities in the auction, the Obama administration took many of the leases off the table, with Interior Secretary Ken Salazar criticizing the process as a headlong rush. And yet, that same administration is choosing to prosecute the young man who blew the whistle on this corrupt process. We cannot let this stand. When Tim disrupted the auction, he did so in the fine tradition of nonviolent civil disobedience that changed so many unjust laws in this country's past. Tim's upcoming trial is an occasion to raise the alarm once more about the peril our planet faces. The situation is still fluid. The trial date has just been set, and local supporters are making plans for how to mark the three-day proceedings. But they are asking people around the country to flood into Salt Lake City in mid-March. If you come, there will be ample opportunity for both legal protest and civil disobedience. For example, outside the courthouse, there will be a mock trial, with experts like NASA's Jim Hansen providing the facts that should be heard inside the chambers. We don't want Tim on trial. We want global warming on the stand. Demonstrators will be using the time-honored tactics of civil disobedience to make their voices heard outside the courthouse in an effort to prevent business as usual. It's business as usual that's wrecking the earth. There will be evening concerts and gatherings, including a mini-summit to share ideas on how the climate movement should proceed in the years ahead. There is a people's movement that draws power from around the globe. For a few days, its headquarters will be in Salt Lake City. You can get the most up-to-date news at climatetrial.com, including schedules for nonviolence training and information about legal representation. If you're coming, bring not only your passion, but also your creativity. We need lots of art and music to help make the point that we don't sit idly by while the government tries to scare the environmental movement into meek cooperation. This kind of trial is nothing but intimidation, and the best answers to intimidation are joy and resolve. That's what we'll need in Utah. We know it's short notice. Some of us won't be able to make it to Utah because we have other commitments or are limiting travel. And if you're in the same situation, climatetravel.com will also have details of solidarity actions in other parts of the country. If you can contribute money to help make the week's events possible, click here, and there will be a link that I'll to this story that I'll put on the blog. So you'll be able to go click on this if you want. But more than your money, we need your body, your brains, and your heart. In a landscape of little water, where Red Rock canyons rise upward like praying hands, we can offer our solidarity to the wild. Wild lands and wild hearts. Tim DeChristopher deserves and needs our physical and spiritual support in the name of a just and vibrant community. Thank you for standing with us. And this letter is signed Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Terry Tempest Williams, and Dr. James Hansen.
I think that might be something worth standing with them for.
I'm just amazed that the government didn't actually, you know, validate that the bidders on these things had money available. It's completely insane.
Well, no, that'd be common sense, wouldn't it?
Completely insane to, hold an auction where you have no idea whether the people who are supposedly putting hundreds of millions of dollars on the table actually have anything to back it up with.
Yeah, it's, you know, if you're going to do background checks for simple jobs, you can probably make sure the people who are going to be paying for stuff can actually afford it.
Yes.
All right. Anything else for that?
I don't think so.
Alrighty then. Article 3. California carbon trading allows timber companies to sell CO2 credits for their worst logging practices. California's race to be the first state to develop a carbon trading program comes at an unacceptable cost for Sierra forests. Public skepticism of carbon trading schemes is growing, and judging by what's happening in California, it is easy to see why. California's race to be the first state to develop a carbon trading program comes at an unacceptable cost for Sierra forests. This fall, the California Air Resources Board, or ARB, with prodding from logging companies and the complicity of some environmental groups, adopted a program that allows timber companies to sell CO2 credits for their worst logging practices, but clear-cutting has no place in any climate change solution. Sierra Pacific Industries is one of the nation's largest logging companies and California's largest private landowner. At a time when other timber companies are moving away from the practice, CPI embraces clear-cutting as part of their core business plan, clearing 20 to 40 acres swaths of forest, then plowing the earth and spreading herbicides like atrazine to kill remaining vegetation. Naturally diverse forests are replaced with uniform, even-aged tree plantations that increase fire risk, ruin watersheds, and disrupt natural carbon sequestration in soil and biomass. The earth is left scarred with only scattered debris piles and so-called ecological islands, twisted solitary trees left standing in the barren tract. California law allows adjacent tracts of forest to be clear-cut every 5 years, leaving a patchwork of homogeneous tree farms where once there was an ecologically diverse forest. Clear-cutting, as practiced by CPI, Green Diamond Resource Company, and other timber companies, is the North American version of deforestation. Governor Schwarzenegger, in his speech in Copenhagen in December, called for local action and California leadership in finding solutions to climate change. I agree, but I believe that we Californians need to set a higher bar for leadership and take a long, hard look at ourselves. The state of California is developing a carbon trading policy through a Byzantine complex of government and quasi-government agencies. The Climate Action Reserve is a non-profit carbon trading broker with strong ties to the governor, Cal EPA, and the Air Resource Board, the state agency responsible for regulating carbon emissions. The chair of CAR's board of directors, Linda Adams, is Schwarzenegger's secretary of Cal EPA, which oversees the Air Resources Board. This intertwined relationship between government and a government organization limits transparency and public participation and allowed the timber industry to cut a backroom deal, forcing clear-cutting into the carbon trading program. CAR has assumed the very governmental role of developing carbon trading protocols, a critical piece of the state's implementation of AB 32, California's greenhouse gas reduction law. They've done this with generous input from industry. The most recent version of the forest carbon trading policy, for example, originated on the computer of a timber industry operative. And last fall, the Air Resource Board, which is a state agency, adopted the CAR policy, creating de facto state regulations. How could this happen? The answer is supply. The carbon market, which is being proposed as the solution to climate change, depends on a ready supply of cheap carbon credits. Without the participation of large private landowners, the largest of which are logging companies, the burgeoning carbon market would fail for lack of carbon sequestration supply. Recognizing this fact, the Schwarzenegger administration, CAR, ARB, and some environmental groups, desperate to get carbon trading online, were ready to compromise to secure the participation of the timber industry. SPI, meanwhile, is in the business of harvesting trees, so CAR, ARB, and the governor cut a deal to pay SPI for business-as-usual practices. The timber industry gets their cake and clear-cutting, too. In September 2009, the Air Resources Board voted to accept revisions to CAR's forest carbon trading rules that lay out what land management and logging practices qualify for carbon credits. This protocol allows a landowner to sell carbon credits for reforesting areas recovering from forest fires, preventing conversion of forest lands to housing or farmlands, and improving their forest harvest practices to promote and maintain native forests. This makes sense. The protocol also includes provisions that permit landowners to collect credits for clear-cutting, termed even-aged management. SPI argues that clear-cutting actually benefits forest carbon sequestration. I can't pronounce that word to save my life. It's a cynical argument. Clear-cutting releases more carbon than a forest fire, while destroying wildlife habitat and water quality along with it. The intensity of clear-cutting and the disturbance of carbon-storing soils and biomass release carbon at levels far greater than less intensive forms of timber harvesting, such as commercial thinning. However, the CAR trading program ignores these emissions, putting them on a punch list for future study. Without an accurate accounting of how much carbon is sequestered, the CAR carbon trading policy lacks integrity and is simply a new revenue stream for logging companies that fails to reduce greenhouse gases. Even though some CAR and ARB board members acknowledged problems with the clear-cutting provision this fall, both bodies refused to delay action on the protocols. The reason became apparent soon after the protocols were adopted. In October, Governor Schwarzenegger and SPI jointly announced that the company was embarking on what they described as the largest forest carbon project in the nation's history. The deal, made possible by the new forest protocol, involves 60,000 acres of SPI land in California and will reportedly sequester 1.5 million tons of CO2. The LA Times estimated that the carbon scale would be worth as much as $10 million to SPI. Supporters for California's carbon trading policy refer to it as the gold standard and hope to export it around the nation and around the world. But in the end, California's carbon trading policy delivers logging companies a new revenue stream without requiring any changes in their worst forestry practices. What we get is more clear-cutting, less carbon sequestration, and a trading that decreases the entire concept of carbon offsets. We cannot clear-cut our way out of climate change. In fact, we shouldn't allow clear-cutting at all. That was a really long article.
Yes, it was.
But I agree. I'm horribly, horribly, horribly against clear cutting. I think that thinning is really important, and I think that's what should be promoted for logging. And my family has had land where that happened, and, you know, all my grandfather charged was said, hey, you can take the trees, just make a road. That was it. Pretty cheap for them.
Yeah, very cheap for them.
But clear cutting is horrible. It's devastating to the land. Yeah, it does. If you drive by a field that's just been clear cut,
it's just 8 million stumps.
It's not nice. Although it does always make me think of that Tiny Toons episode.
I'm not sure which one you're referring to, and I've seen lots of Tiny Toons episodes. That's okay.
Yeah. It'd take too long to describe, and I just spent a long time reading that article. So.
Yeah. Apparently, Avagdu is going to be joining us soon.
Cool. I'm up for that.
But in the meantime, I will first have to send him the running order. And then shut down our current Skype call now.
Hello, everyone. This is Avagdu. Joining the show today, surprisingly enough. So am I reading this story, or...?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So, we got an open carry story here today. Open carry advocates fight to meet while packing. Walnut Creek, California. Gathering of men and women packing heat on Locust Street in Walnut Creek Sunday turned more than a few heads. What we're trying to do is educate people on what the law is, make sure they know what their options are. Said, some guy who's an open carry advocate. Shahab is his name, was one of the 50 who gathered at Buckhorn Grill Saturday to exercise the right to openly carry handguns. Most carried holstered handguns and clips of ammunition. Well, yeah. It's just a personal choice that a lot of us make to have a method of protecting oneself, said John Schwartz, an open carry advocate. Concealed weapons in California require a special permit, which, by the way, is almost impossible to get because it's not a shall issue state like Washington. You pretty much have to be law enforcement or retired law enforcement to get it. There's only a couple thousand people in all of California that have a concealed carry permit. But it is legal to openly carry an unloaded handgun and ammunition with some exceptions. Well, that's interesting. Okay, so it's not exactly open carry, as I know it, at least from Washington. The biggest issue is the school zone, so you cannot go within 1,000 feet of a kindergarten through 12 school unless you'll be violating the law, said Shabab. That's a weird way of saying it. Yeah, I guess that makes sense, though. You know, being able to carry an unloaded handgun with ammunition, I mean, if you carry that, I mean, carry it on your person, that's interesting. Usually the law is specific about that, but that's interesting. It kind of makes sense, so I kind of, you know. Anyway, some shoppers walked by the group without noticing they were armed. It was police officers or something, which most people think. Bruce Hibarb, Oradina resident, and the reaction to the gathering was mixed. I think it's inappropriate for ordinary people to carry guns, said a sheeple who lives in Pleasanton, resident. I think that's great. I want to have one, too, said Camilla Silvers, a Benicia resident. The open carry advocates meet in a variety of restaurants and coffee shops, including Starbucks. Well, thank you, Starbucks. That has angered some groups, including the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, which Friday started a petition to drive to persuade Starbucks to ban guns in its stores. Thankfully, Starbucks can actually, you know, decide that for themselves. The Brady Campaign was unsuccessful in persuading Buckhorn's management to stop this meeting by banning guns in its restaurant. They're putting not only their customers at risk, but their employees at risk by encouraging people to bring lethal weapons onto their property. Karen, arts and coordinator for California and Brady chapters, unfortunately, she doesn't know that the people that open carry probably have the most stringent gun discipline and safety of anybody who carries a gun. But that's, you know, just something that they probably don't know about. Artston said it's persuaded Pete's Coffee and Teas to ban guns in the stores after a similar gathering last month. I actually do know about that because they had the same policy in Washington. And it was put on a do not patronize list for the open carry forms. It may be legal for me to strap a machete around my waist and go down to local playground, but reasonable people would find that intimidating, and this is an act of intimidation. No, intimidation is intimidation, not, you know, the tools you carry around with you.
Carrying a tool around is not intimidation, even if the tool also happens to be a weapon.
Yeah. Well, as I always say, and I'm fond of saying, is that a weapon is in its application. I can use a hammer as a weapon, or I can use it to hammer nails. I can use a handgun to shoot somebody, or I can use it to shoot holes in paper. It's very expensive to, you know, use it just to shoot holes in paper, but if I wanted to, I could do that. We're not intending to intimidate people or scare people, which is something many people think we're trying to do, said Shabab. It seems like there should be more to that sentence. These open carry supporters say they want the law to change to allow them to carry loaded guns in California. But for now, they plan to continue meeting and they will likely turn more heads. And that's very interesting. And, you know, anybody who's trained in operating firearms know that they can load that fairly quickly if, you know, something were to happen. I don't know what the laws are here concerning regards to using a handgun to prevent a felony, but in Washington you could use a firearm to prevent any felony, which was encouraging to me, I think.
Yeah, I don't understand her comment about, what was it? They're putting not only their customers at risk, but their employees at risk by encouraging people to bring lethal weapons onto the property. That's a load of crap.
Because yeah, they're probably putting people more at risk by serving French fries.
Well, I know that all the people that I've heard talk about open carry, all of them that actually choose to open carry have a retention holster, and so that gun is not going anywhere if they don't want it to, you know. No one can like run by and grab it, you know, and especially if it's not loaded. You know, I mean, it would be really unlikely for some random person to be able to disarm
you. You could pistol whip someone, but, you know, they could probably hit you with their fist, too.
Yeah, it's true.
Because I don't know, I think it's a stupid argument saying that someone carrying a gun is dangerous and lethal when someone who is a black belt is dangerous and lethal, but you're not going to say you can't go into any buildings because you're a dangerous weapon.
And
if you're trained to properly use something, then you're going to be safe with it. Or at least if you have common sense, you're going to be safe with it. And if you don't have common sense, you're probably not properly trained.
Yeah. And I do know that the laws for possessing a handgun in California are a little bit more stringent as far as what you have to go through to get one. I don't think it's the normal, you know, just the 3-day waiting period thing that most states have. I think it's a little bit more comprehensive than that. But I don't know for sure because I haven't tried to buy a handgun here yet. I probably will at some point, but when it's so much easier to do it in other states... then, you know, then it's not that big of a deal. I'm kind of here out of economic necessity right now, so. But.
Well, I think we all know the economy sucks right now.
Yeah. And with that, and with all the things that could result in the way the comedy's going, I thought it was a good idea to be closer to my family, so that if anything did happen, that we would be able to deal with it together at least.
Good plan. Okay, so let's move on to the next story. U.S. Trade Representative seeking public comment. Rashmi at Public Knowledge has some good news. The USTR is seeking comment from copyright, trademark, and patent holders. This is a golden opportunity to make a persuasive argument, en masse, for balanced copyright. She has very detailed instructions in the post, including where to make your comments and the specific docket you must reference. The deadline is February 16th. Which turns out it's 3 days ago. I put this in a while ago. See the ACTA tag on my site or the EFF action alert of ACTA for information to consider when compiling your remarks. And ACTA has not yet been finalized, so there may still be hope. Unfortunately, this whole treaty has been negotiated pretty much entirely in secret, which is really incredibly freaking stupid. And
I haven't heard a whole lot about this. Can you give a summary of it?
Sure. ACTA is the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which you would think, you know, counterfeiting would be counterfeit physical goods, but the documents which have been leaked so far all point to basically an international three strikes of copyright violation and you're off the internet type of situation.
Oh, right, yeah.
but it has been negotiated in secret, so we don't really know the details.
I see.
So, it's been pissing me off ever since I heard about it, because they shouldn't be negotiating this kind of thing in secret. They should be doing it openly. Because...
Yep.
You know, all of the citizens of the countries that signed the treaty are going to be affected by it.
Well, yeah, uh-huh. It goes back to something, an article that I read recently about, it had to do with Google deleting a whole bunch of music blogs, something like that, where someone has permission, but someone else says, no, you don't. And if it says you're violating a copyright when you have permission from the copyright holder, I don't know. I think it's just a bad idea to have a strike system.
Yeah, I was having a discussion about this with my dad the other day. You know, they have no idea whether or not you have permission from the copyright holder in a lot of cases, or if you have a right to the material under fair use. This comes into question a lot where you have things in which you do own, but you, for whatever reason, want a digital version, which is fine under fair use. Format shifting is allowed. And for whatever reason, maybe, let's say for instance that you had a movie on Laserdisc or something like that, and you know, obviously you're after your Laserdisc breaks, you're probably not going to be able to fix it, so you go online and you get the equivalent, you know, file format and watch it on your computer, or you have a old game system that doesn't work anymore, that you own the game and you download a game and, you know, run an emulation or whatever. Specifically, that latter circumstance happens a lot, and you know, they would still probably try to send you a copyright violation notice or a takedown notice for doing something like that, in which they don't know whether you actually own that or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, You know, I don't think that they should be trying... I don't think they should be able to send these kind of notices or at least restrict anyone without physical evidence, which they could only get through a warrant.
Yeah.
So, that's my take on it.
I think that's a fair take on fair use.
Yeah.
Well, I think they're trying... I think that they've been trying to get rid of fair use for a long time. You know, the DMCA had some pretty...
some nasty
provisions. Effects on... Yes, yes.
What was it? Circumventing encryption devices or something?
Yeah, that's another part of it, too. That's worrisome because a lot of these basically means that any of these games that check in with servers or have encryption of any kind, you know, it's illegal to break that encryption, meaning that when the company decides not to support the game anymore, that you're not going to be able to run it without breaking the law.
Okay, well, let's move on to the next story, since we seem to have talked that one out.
Alrighty, it's another long article. Okay. Obama admin demands justification for health insurers' 39% rate hike. Insurers spent nearly $9.5 million lobbying against health reforms. CEO's annual salary tops $10 million. Obama admin demands justification for health insurers' 39% rate hike. It's an issue that strikes at the core of America's health reform debate. How much should one have to pay to ensure their health care needs are met? Now, take that price and inflate it by up to 39%. Just to get a feel for what it is like to be one of roughly 800,000 American Blue Cross customers in California who hold individual policies. The company said its dramatic rate hike would take effect on March 1st. State legislators almost immediately promised to investigate the increase. Then, on Monday, the Obama administration got involved. In a letter to U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, called for the insurer to publicly explain why it raised premiums. With so many families already affected by rising costs, I was very disturbed to learn through media accounts that Anthem Blue Cross plans to raise premiums for its California customers by as much as 39%, or 15 times faster than inflation, Sebelius wrote. The rate hikes were even more difficult to understand in the light of soaring profits at Anthem Blue Cross's parent company, WellPoint Incorporated, Sebelius said. WellPoint earned $2.7 billion in the last quarter of 2009, she said, calling on the insurance company to provide a detailed justification for the increase. Additionally, WellPoint CEO Angela Braly earns an annual salary of nearly $10 million and held nearly $2 million in stock options at the end of 2008. Additionally, WellPoint spent nearly $9.5 million on lobbying against health reforms in 2009, labor advocate group AFL-CIO noted in a recent release. As we continue the health insurance reform debate in Washington, this announcement reminds us that too many Americans can be left with unaffordable insurance each time the rates or rules change in the private market, Sebelius said. Last month, plans to reform the U.S. healthcare system hit a wall when the election of a Republican to the Senate Massachusetts seat, long held by Ted Kennedy, robbed the Democrats of their 60-vote majority in the Senate. President Obama vowed during his campaign for the White House to reform health care and make coverage accessible to the 47 million Americans who currently do not have any, and to make coverage less of a financial drain on U.S. workers. We understand and strongly share our members' concern over the rising cost of health care services and the corresponding adverse impact on the company said in a statement noted by the Los Angeles Times. Unfortunately, the individual market premiums are merely the symptoms of a larger underlying problem in California's individual market, rising health care costs. In a Monday response to Sebelius' letter, the insurer seemed to echo the oft-repeated Republican talking point that Obama's proposed health care reforms must be scrapped and begun anew. "We regret the impact this has on our members," the company said, according to the Washington Post. "It highlights why we need sustainable health care reform to manage the steadily rising costs of hospitals, drugs, and doctors. As such, it is important to go back to the beginning and get health care reform done right." President Obama has said he does not want to start from scratch on his package of health reforms and plans to hold a televised health summit with Republicans on February 25th. A recent Harvard study published by the American Journal of Public Health found that over 45,000 Americans die every year for lack of health insurance, more than the number of Americans killed by kidney disease. Sebelius' full letter follows. February 8th, 2010. So, yeah that, we could probably just put a link up for it, wouldn't we? Yeah, that's a really long letter. So, but that's... I really don't like insurance companies at all.
I don't like insurance companies either. But I think there's a lot to this story that isn't being talked about.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean... people like to make this issue so simple when they haven't really studied the options available for people and the history that kind of brought us to the point that we are at now. Mm-hmm. And you know, for me, the supply of medical doctors, for instance, is kind of artificially kept low by organizations like the American Medical Association, and it harms things like specialists who want to be good at something in particular, but not good at other things. So if you wanted to go to somebody that just, for instance, does stitches or something like that, or sets broken bones, you can't really do that because the person has to be, you know, a licensed doctor in everything. And so that keeps costs high because the doctors have to do all this education, obviously. As well, with the insurance, the whole insurance thing is high because people don't know what the price is. And it's interesting that they mentioned Blue Cross here because I recently got their coverage, and it was a third of the price that what I was paying before, though I am in a company plan, so I don't know if it's an individual, like they said, you know, an individual account.
Yeah, it was for the people who don't have it through companies and stuff like that, people who are paying for it on their own.
Right, and I would say that it is very expensive if you're paying for it on your own. I was doing that for a while. And, you know, I'm fairly healthy, and I mean, I'm in the group that they like to get because, you know, we don't get sick and all that kind of stuff. And the cost was very high, even just for catastrophic coverage. So much so that I often thought about just canceling it. You know, it's a high. It was probably one of my second highest bills besides food. You know, so I mean, it was pretty high.
I've been paying. I haven't had health insurance for over 2 years now, and been paying for all my medical care out of pocket. And I finally got all my medical bills paid off. Very happy about, but I don't know. I think It gets to a certain point where it's just, is it worth paying for it, or would it be better to just pay for the medical care out of pocket?
Right,
and
right.
I think it depends on who you go through.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, mm-hmm. is that, you know, if more people actually paid it out of pocket, then the prices would likely go down because people are going to be shopping around, competitive, and people actually know what the price is. Right now, most people don't even know what the price is because they pay the copay, they go in, they pay the copay, they hand them the card. They don't know how much anything costs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it also depends. Like, you can have what you think of as your normal annual doctor visit. It's mostly for women. We go in and see our special doctors, and you pay so much, and then you go in the next year expecting the same thing, and you can have a completely different amount on there. So it can, you know, for us at least, it can range in price from just being simple $150 to $450 because of one or two tests different. And people don't realize that, you know, for anything, whether you're getting your throat swabbed for strep or you're getting blood drawn, that stuff is expensive.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it's just ridiculous, but you know, you got to pay for all the stuff that goes into it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, like I said before, you know, the training and all that stuff, there's massive amounts of material. It costs a lot to keep places sterile. Equipment costs a lot of money. So, I mean, they have to pay off all those capital goods. But after that point, though, you know, I mean, I'm just, you know, I don't know. I don't really know what the costs are once they actually get all, when do they actually get all that stuff paid off? You know, what, you know, how much percentage they need before
who's,
all that
who's
stuff.
Who's making how much kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's more than just the cost of normal health care, you know? I mean, we pay insurance, we go to a normal doctor. Well, what if you want to go to a naturalistic doctor or someone who practices naturopathy? What if you want to go to the what's considered alternative because nothing else has worked for you? And a lot of insurance companies won't pay for you to go see these other doctors, even if it could save your life. And I think that's kind of a real tragedy of insurance companies. A lot of them aren't willing to do what is good for the customer. They want the money and that's it. And there are other insurance companies that do want to help you, and they're willing to say, okay, we'll look into it, and actually mean it.
So,
like I said, I think it really depends on who you go with.
So. Well, yeah. What I was going to mention, I guess it's not so much with health insurance, but just to relate this, I guess, to a different kind of insurance, like, you know, car insurance or something. There's not very many states that that, you know, allow you not to have car insurance. You have to have car insurance. You know, you have to buy it. And so that gives the providers of that insurance more leverage over people because they have to use their product, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's not as much in the same way. I mean, health insurance is, companies don't have all the same stick, but I mean, if I do it through a company, I'm very much incentivized to use the company's plan, and I'm not very incentivized to use somebody else, you know, their competitor or whatever. As well, you know, like states like Massachusetts, you know, require you to have health insurance coverage. And I think, you know, I don't know what Obama's plans are, but it sounds like it's kind of going that way.
Yeah, I would be happy if they lean towards Hawaii's system, because I know that they have government mandated healthcare in Hawaii, and I think that's, you know, it's been working for them.
So. Well, I mean, there's one thing as far as having a nationwide pool could lower the cost for that particular pool, obviously. Because there's more people in it, and that's the way insurance works. But, you know, on the other hand, it's also, again, you have the calculation problem with the cost. Yeah. Because, you know, it's not free. You're going to pay for it with taxes. You just don't mm-hmm. know exactly where what is allocated to what necessarily.
Well, yeah. When people bring up taxes, it's like, here in Nebraska, I don't know what my taxes go to. They say that it's for this or for that, and then you look at a lot of the stuff, and it's like, where the hell did the money go to?
Right.
And in Omaha specifically, it went to the paychecks of the people in politics in the city. They decreased the school budget when Omaha got a new mayor. They decreased the school budget. They decreased the budget for, I believe, road workers, including like construction on the roads and stuff like that, just basic maintenance. And they had to redo a contract with the firefighters, trying to decrease the amount of firefighters per truck. And they were saying, you know, at first people were trying to figure out, you know, was it to fix the deficit that we had? And then it came out that it was so they could increase the salary of everyone that had just been voted in. Like there was one guy, the previous salary last year for one of the assistants to the mayor was, I think it was a total of like 40 or 50 something, 1,000 something. And then the new guy's making 94,000.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we say we have to increase taxes for something, I think we need to really, really look and inspect and see, okay, where exactly is the tax money going? Because you can raise all the taxes you want, but if it's not going to what you say it's going to, there will be hell to pay if it comes out. So, you know, if taxes are raised, as long as the money does go to healthcare, I personally wouldn't work. I have a minimum wage job. So if someone in my position would be able to afford taxes for healthcare, as long as it does go to healthcare, I have no problem with that. So I think someone who's making $200,000 a year should be able to afford that too. But yeah. But on a different little angle with this whole thing, I think more emphasis needs to be placed on preventative care, not just from doctors, but starting at home. You know, don't give your kids horribly processed food for breakfast and have them eat the crappy school lunch. And I'm not saying all school lunches are crappy, just some of them are. And don't have them come home and have greasy, salty, sugary snacks. Just, you know, take care of yourself, take care of your kids. You'll be able to avoid some of the doctor bills, you know, stuff like that. But I think I'm done. I'm done.
Okay. No more ranting. More.
So whose story is it anyway?
I believe it's a Vlog Deuce.
Okay, I'll read this. Gingrich corrects Gaffey.
Gaff.
I don't know. Gaff? That's flip-flop. Maybe Newt Gingrich just ought to hold his tongue on terrorists and U.S. law. Earlier this week, the former House Speaker said the shoe bomber Richard Reid was American and therefore was properly read his Miranda rights by the Bush administration. But Reid is British, and now Gingrich says he meant would-be domestic terrorist Jose Padilla. So we're good now, right? Well, not quite. Because Gingrich added on Twitter, treating terrorists like criminals, wrong no matter who is prez. In line with current Republican talking points, but exactly the opposite of what he said in 2005 about the Bush administration moving Padilla's case from military to civilian court. Then Gingrich agreed with the Bush line that there's no set in stone perfect way to try terrorists, the very stance Sam Stein points out he's now criticizing from President Obama. Mark Ambiner sees another angle, Gingrich praising Bush for originally holding Padilla in a military brig and subjecting him to harsh interrogation. But Ambiner notes for the Atlantic, Padilla didn't talk before his eventual transfer to civilian court. So Gingrich's reference is proof that Bush administration used a different practice and that it worked, so far removed from the point that he's trying to make it is, to quote Wolfgang Pauli, not even wrong. I don't know why anybody cares what Newt Gingrich says anyway.
Yeah, I had fun watching, we said her name earlier.
Rachel Maddow?
Yeah, Rachel Maddow. I knew there was an M in there somewhere. Yeah, I had fun watching her. I think it was last night or the night before, her show where she was showing a whole bunch of clips and then correcting them. It was kind of entertaining.
Yeah, I've seen the clips online, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet.
She has this smarminess about her that I find oh so appealing. But there were several people at that whatever convention it was. Something with the Republicans all acting stupid. But it was
isn't that just every day with Republicans?
With most of them. I will say there are some intelligent Republicans I can deal with, like Meghan McCain we mentioned earlier. So there are some that I can tolerate. For the most part.
Does anybody know more about this Deborah Medina thing going on? Because I don't really know that much. Besides what Alex Jones says.
I'm a little afraid of him.
This one thing?
Okay, never mind.
And I long ago dismissed Alex Jones as a complete nut job.
Deborah Medina is running for governor in Texas, I think. Governor? Something. Anyway, some position over there in Texas. I'm not in Texas, so... But she sounded like she knew what she was talking about. She wanted to abolish the property tax, which I thought was a good idea.
Yeah.
I think that can be for certain situations. I mean, out here in the specific area where I live, we use the property tax for... It's not even called property tax. It's basically lot rent. Because every household owns the lot that they're on. But they call it lot rent because the money that comes from it goes to maintaining the roads and the lake and stuff like
that.
Well,
that's a lot more honest, at least.
Well, yeah, we know exactly where it goes to.
But they admit that you're renting the land from the government, even if they give you something that says deed to whatever your address is.
Yeah, technically it's not even the government. We're renting it from the people who originally founded the housing development.
Huh.
So... But we can do whatever we want with it, so that's good.
I do what I want. I'm going to do it anyway. Anyway.
Yeah, they tried to pass a few rules a couple years ago. They're like, you can't have more than this many cars in your yard. If you have a boat, it has to be this many yards away from the road. And people were like, that's not going to work. So they dropped it.
Yeah, see, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. It illustrates that even these housing associations, which I'm assuming is kind of what you're referring to.
Yeah, it's similar.
Yeah. When the people who actually, occupy this area decide that those laws or rules or whatever that they want to try to enforce are not good, then they, their rules are unmarketable to these people, which,
is good. Yeah, the main thing with it is that this is technically private property, so they can't really, the bylaws can't be enforced by a cop unless they actually... coincide with real laws like property damage and stuff like that.
Right.
The only time we're actually able to enforce it is if it puts people's lives or property at risk. There is a bylaw out here saying there can't be any ATVs or things like that going down the roads. The roads are only wide enough for two vehicles to go down at a time. Mm-hmm. So if you have someone on an ATV flying past you, my mom was literally run off the road last year by a kid on a four-wheeler and stuff like that, you actually can call the police and have it interfere. And that's really the only bylaw they've stuck with. Everything else has gone out the window because it just wasn't practical. Like the, you can only have so many cars in your driveway.
Mm-hmm.
So like, well,
that's very
we
interesting and light, insight into that sort of housing arrangement, I think. And for the most part, I think it's pretty positive.
Mm-hmm. It's nice because
a lot of people
will
get scared of saying, you have a private housing development and it's going to be tyrannical, but obviously it's worked out pretty well.
Not pretty nice. The biggest thing that influences that is when they have a monthly meeting. The first Tuesday of every month they have a meeting, and it's not just for the shareholders, which are basically the housing, the owners out here. It can be their kids can come with, and everyone who shows up has a say. Mm-hmm. So if enough people were to want chicken coops out here, I'm pretty sure they'd allow that.
I like me some chicken.
They're kind of fun to watch until they start chasing you. Then he's not fun anymore.
He's crazy. Australian guy.
Doesn't he have ducks, too?
He does. Yes, he does.
I like ducks. Ducks are awesome. All right, should we move on?
yeah, we should probably do something that's actually in our running order.
Productive. Got completely offline there.
Okay.
Sorry, sounds fun.
Yes, hopefully everyone was amused by our long digression. But anyway, on to the next story. New national security distraction. Arabic language students. Today, the ACLU filed a lawsuit on behalf of Nick George, a Pomona College student who was detained and aggressively interrogated by Transportation Security Administration authorities, by the FBI, and by Pennsylvania police when he tried to board a plane carrying Arabic language flashcards. You heard right. Not liquids, not matches, not a bomb. Flashcards.
Oh no!
George, a physics major who's studying Arabic, was pulled aside for secondary screening at the Philadelphia International Airport as he tried to go through security. When he emptied his pockets, the inspector saw his flashcards and he was arrested, handcuffed, locked in a cell for hours, and aggressively questioned because of some flashcards. The following exchange took place between George and a TSA supervisor who questioned him. TSA supervisor, you know who did 9/11? George, Osama bin Laden. TSA supervisor, do you know what language he spoke? George, Arabic. At that point, the TSA supervisor held up George's flashcards, which had words such as to smile and funny on them, and said, do you see why these cards are suspicious? Ah, the smoking gun.
I would have just said no, I have no idea.
I would have too.
Because, no, I don't know who did it on 9/11. Actually, that's probably the truth.
Mm-hmm. You know, Osama bin Laden didn't actually do it because the people who did
it
died when the planes crashed into the towers. So,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I have no idea what their names are.
Yeah, exactly.
they're kind of toasty.
Yeah. Okay, but the rest of the story. Here's the problem. During George's ordeal, no fewer than 7 law enforcement officers took part in detaining and questioning him. The unnecessary arrest, detentioning, and question of someone who, like George, poses no threat to flight safety makes everyone less safe by diverting resources away from real threats. Real threats. George said today, as someone who travels by plane, I want TSA agents to do their job to keep flights safe. I don't understand how locking me up and harassing me just because I was carrying the flashcards made anybody safer. No one should be treated like a criminal for simply learning one of the most widely spoken languages in the world. One of the FBI agents who questioned him put it best, we think. At the end of his ordeal, he said to George, "The police call us to evaluate whether there is a real threat. You are not a real threat." Yeah, he's not a real threat because he's got freaking flashcards. They're made out of paper! There is no way to make paper explode.
He's gonna paper cut the pilot to death.
Don't try to learn new languages.
Watch out, I have salt too. Oh my god. Seriously? Come on.
Because
this is
he
ridiculous.
Could actually help, you know, these government agencies and, you know, the military and all this kind of stuff if he learned Arabic.
Let's harass him instead. That'll make us look good.
Yeah, now he certainly won't want to learn Arabic anymore.
If they ever approach him in the future, he can be like, no thank you.
Maybe he'll switch to Farsi or Sanskrit or something else that's written in a non-Latin alphabet. Which, if it's not Asian,
You should learn cuneiform.
No. It's got to be something that's, you know, a living language, not something that hasn't been used in thousands of years.
Hey, I learned how to do cuneiform in high school. Come on, it's still used.
Yeah.
Just depends on where you are.
When was the last time after high school that you used it? Never?
I've translated it.
Well, we'll grab you when we're going to do our, desert expedition.
All right. If we ever go to ancient Babylon, I'll be right there.
Thanks. I appreciate that. I'll go grab my time machine.
Sweet.
Gigawatts.
1.21 gigawatts.
See, I couldn't remember, so I'm glad someone picked up on it.
And 88 miles per hour.
Okay, then.
Okay. I'm not sure what 88 miles per hour has to do with anything. I can understand the energy requirements, but why the speed?
Yeah.
People like fast things.
Fast car.
Alrighty.
Am I going to read this one?
Yeah, I'll take it. Security guards do nothing as 15-year-old girl is beaten. The 15-year-old girl thought the three security guards in the Seattle bus tunnel would protect her from attack. She was wrong. As the footage below shows, the guards watched and did nothing as the girl was punched, thrown to the ground, kicked repeatedly in the face, and then robbed. The girl told a detective that the group followed her from a nearby department store into the bus tunnel. The guards didn't intervene because they have standing orders to observe and report, but not to try to stop fights or criminal activity. That protocol is now under review. I should say, I've actually seen the footage for this. The statements were revealed in court papers filed Wednesday against the teenage girl who attacked the victim and the three young men accused of stealing her purse, phone, and iPod. All four were charged with robbery. Although she was not hospitalized, the victim said she lost consciousness during the attack and had to see a doctor. The incident, which occurred on January 28th, is being investigated by the King County Sheriff's Office and the Metro Transit Police, and Office spokesman Sergeant John Eucart. Transit tunnel security officers were on the platform and witnessed the assault, said Eucart in a statement. However, they did not intercede as they are unarmed civilian employees. They were giant-ass men. I think they could have done something.
Yes,
Metro Transit General... Well, yeah, yeah. Don't do it!
Their orders say, you're not a security guard, you're a CCTV camera.
Yeah, pretty much. All right. Metro Transit General Manager Kevin Desmond did not agree. We are very disappointed in what people see in that video, Desmond said. It was absolutely unacceptable. I know the Olympic security folks were also disappointed in the response, but again, the employees were following the letter of the agreement. The Seattle Times published an editorial shortly after the video was released Wednesday, condemning the inaction of the guards and questioning the multi-billion-dollar contract the Transit Authority has with private security firms. What indeed are taxpayers and transit riders paying for? Three security guards doing nothing. One would be plenty, given the job description and expectations. So the message for the traveling public is simple. There is no security in the bus tunnel. If a rider needs directions or perhaps has some self-esteem issues to discuss, maybe the folks in the reflective vest can help. Otherwise, tough luck, you're on your own. Now, I saw this video, and it blew my mind. They were literally less than 3 feet away, 3 feet away from the girl getting the crap kicked out of her. And at the very end of it, one reached over and looked like he was saying, hey, you should stop.
Oh my
I don't
God.
Care. I honestly, I'd risk my job. I'd knock their bitch asses out just to stop the beating.
This or at is least why try. We need the earlier story about having armed men.
Exactly.
Who are civilians and not employees of the bus company.
Yeah, exactly.
You can just go, stop that, or I'll shoot you.
Yeah. This is Washington. I can use my firearm to stop this felony. Yeah.
That was beyond ridiculous. Who the hell would do that? I should rephrase that. Who with a heart or soul would do Seriously? That's just ridiculous.
Yeah. I don't know. I hope they're not paying that much for these guys, because they're obviously not doing very much.
Yeah. Well, they said they were being paid with taxpayer money.
Yeah, I know.
See, just another example. Know where your freaking tax dollars go.
And exactly what services it is that are being provided by the people you're paying.
Yeah,
because
obviously no service.
If they're security guards, you expect them to act as, you know, providing security, which I would expect means customers not getting beaten up.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, there's probably plenty of laws making them, you know, probably they're pretty much hampered, probably even more than a, you know, normal person bearing arms would be. But at the same time, you know, it's like if they're not effective, you have to change the policy. So, yeah, well, I hope something actually gets done about this. You know, I'm kind of doubtful that something would, but, you know, I don't mean just that these guys are fired. I mean, I hope that that's probably, like, the least that happens. But I really hope that they do get somebody who's actually going to do something about it, you know, who's actually going to stop crimes instead of just watching them happen. Okay, then. Does anybody else have anything to say about that? Or I'll move on.
Nope. I think it's time to move on.
Okay. Awkward silence. All right.
That's okay. I will make some music before I release this to the public.
Excellent. I knew that was for something. Cell phone users, your privacy is at risk constantly. If you own a cell phone, you should not care about the outcome of a case scheduled to be argued in federal... Oh, you should care about a case, sorry. About the outcome of a case scheduled to be argued in federal court appeals in Philadelphia. Could well decide whether the government can use your cell phone to track you. It already does, even if it hasn't shown probable cause to believe it will turn up in evidence of a crime. I thought they already had that ability. I don't know. Anyway, American Civil Liberties Union, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Center for Democracy and Technology will ask the court to require that the government at least show probable cause before they can track your whereabouts. Well, that's reasonable. Or, actually, probable cause, that's not... I say warrant. Although most people don't realize that cell phones double as tracking devices. Yes, they do. They triangulate. They cannot operate without tracking you. And they also have... Most of them have specific location dealy bobbers so that 911 can find you. And GPS. Your phones can have GPS chips. The same technology allows car navigations to know where you are and give you directions. Turn right now. But even older phones that don't have the chips can be tracked down by knowing the location of cell towers they use to connect to a network. That's what I just said. Triangulation. There's cell phones and cell phone records can be useful for police officers who need to track the movements of those they believe to be breaking the law. And it's important for law enforcement agencies to have the tools they need to stop crimes. However, it's just important to make sure such tools are used responsibly in a manner that safeguards our personal privacy, like, you know, innocent until proven guilty and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
The documents obtained by the ACLU... EFF is part of the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that show the government takes advantage of this technology to track cell phones as extensively as possible, often without first obtaining warrants. Except in states where courts step in to establish boundaries. Yeah, that would be a good idea. In fact, this issue gained national attention during last year's
gubernatorial.
Okay. In New Jersey. documents turned over in our lawsuit revealed that the U.S. Attorney's Office under Chris Christie, now the governor, was tracking cell phones without probable cause, in violation of Justice Department recommendation. The decision reached by Philadelphia-based Third Circuit Court of Appeals will not only bind federal courts through Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, it will also be a key source of guidance to courts around the country as they grapple with this issue. Grappling. Judo. We hope the court will send a message that merely carrying a cell phone should not make people more susceptible to government surveillance. Well, gosh, I hope not, because, like, everybody has a cell phone, right? No one wants to...
And it's never on.
Feel as if the government agent is following her wherever she goes, be it a friend's house, a place of work, a therapist's office. Innocent Americans shouldn't have to feel that way. Well, yeah. Government has argued that one who does not wish to disclose wants to the government might use a cellular telephone. Wait, what? Okay. Well, I suppose that is a choice. Like, you shouldn't drive on roads either.
No, the sidewalks are better for that.
I mean, they're kind of right, but, you know, at the same time, it's a little ridiculous.
Yeah.
Startling and dismaying statement coming from the United States. The government is supposed to care about people's privacy. Yeah, right, okay. Should not be forcing the nation's 277 million cell phone subscribers between risking being tracked and going in without an essential communications tool. Okay, 277 million cell phone subscribers. How many people are in the U.S., I wonder?
Well, the last census was 287 million, I think.
That means there's 10 million people without cell phones.
Yes.
They're probably toddlers.
Actually, there's...
people who don't know how to use them.
Well, there's actually more people than that without cell phones, because I know of several people who have multiple cell phones because they have their own personal cell phone plus one for work.
That's true.
Well, I wonder how they're calculating the subscribers, though, because it could... Anyway, yes, there's some people out there that don't have cell phones. I think we should have nationwide cell phone coverage for all Americans. I'm going to lobby for that one. Okay. I'm joking, of course. What's at stake is not whether it's okay for the government to track location cell phones. We agree that cell phone tracking is lawful and appropriate in certain situations.
Like when you have a warrant?
Yeah.
Or actual probable cause, not we think he's guilty.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe some evidence. The question is whether the government should first have to show this good reason. Think such tracking will turn up evidence of crime. Will turn up evidence. No, they should have evidence that you're a criminal already. Okay, anyway. We believe it should. This case is not about protecting criminals, it's about protecting innocent people from unjustified violations of their privacy. Yeah, okay. Anyhow.
Mm-hmm. Ironically enough, I have a track phone. it's only on when I need to make a call.
Yeah.
Because otherwise the battery dies really quickly.
Yeah. Well, some of them, I don't know if it's all of them, but some of them actually, I'm told, I don't know this for sure, but they still have tracking capability as long as the battery is inside the phone. Which, you know, I mean, like, that's kind of unreasonable for most people, you know. I'm not that paranoid, personally.
Yeah.
You know, to take my battery out of the phone. But if you are one of those people listening that are concerned about that, then that's what you have to do. Just let you know a little tidbit of info.
Oh, gosh.
Just be safe.
Say that with a very threatening tone.
Well, you do want to be safe from the government, don't you?
I got a kick out of it. What can I say?
Okay. This kind of reminds me of one of the first articles we ever did for the show with the GPS on the car.
I am?
Yes, that's right. Actually, I believe that was the very first show we ever did.
Nostalgia.
Good
yes.
times.
Takes me back.
Tastes like love.
Okay, so apparently we don't have much to talk about on that particular topic.
It sucks.
Yes.
Awkward silence.
We all agree.
Okay, so our next story. More Americans favor eliminating the filibuster. One of the greatest obstacles to passing progressive legislation in Congress has been the use of the filibuster in the Senate. With upwards of 40 cloture votes since the start of the 111th Congress in January, this Senate is on pace to record the largest number of filibuster roll calls, transforming what was intended to be a seldom-used procedural tactic into an all-out tool for obstructionism. Now, a new CBS/New York Times poll finds that more Americans support ending the filibuster and requiring legislation to pass by a simple majority. As you may know, the Senate operates under procedures that effectively require 60 votes out of 100 for most legislation to pass, allowing a minority of as few as 41 senators to block a majority. Do you think this procedure should remain in place, or do you think it should be changed so that legislation is passed with a simple majority? Should remain, 44%. Should be changed, 50%. Don't know, 6%. Changing the filibuster would not be without precedent. In 1975, the filibuster threshold was lowered from 67 to 60. Tom Harkin and Jean Shaheen have introduced legislation that would change Senate procedure to create a four-step process that would eventually allow a majority of 51 votes, rather than 60, for cloture, ending debate and moving to a final vote on passage of a bill. Yet Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has dismissed the effort as unlikely to succeed. Open Left's Chris Bowers has an ongoing whip count.
Ironic.
Yeah. Has an ongoing whip count for the effort to pass Harkin's reforms here. So, interesting changes to the way our government works.
I don't trust the majority, so...
Yeah, I don't either.
That's all I have to say.
I think that probably if we have a 100-seat Senate, a bill should require 66 votes to pass. Because if you can't convince two-thirds of the people it's a good idea, maybe you should go look to see whether it's a good idea again.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I really dislike the filibuster unless it's used for something that actually is important. I don't think that it should be something that they're doing and they're just, you know, time after time after time. I think, I don't know, maybe an allotment of so many per year would possibly be better than eliminating it altogether. But I don't like it, but I don't know if eliminating it is the answer.
Tough questions.
But
okay.
Then again, so, I don't know, maybe we should just be smarter with our voting in politicians. Actually vote people in who we believe in. And if they don't, then kick their asses out.
Yes, instead of instead of people, you know, keeping on reelecting Ted Kennedy until he's dead. Kind of surprised he didn't win, even though he is dead.
Seriously, how do they stay in there for so long?
Zombie Reagan. Sorry.
Sorry, I'm right. I'm in Family Guy. Reagan smash.
Oh man.
Okay then. Are we on to the next one? Is it my turn?
Yes.
Oh,
God. Let's skip over the awkward silence this time.
Okay. U.S. media omission. Iran calls for global nuclear disarmament. The American public has not been informed by the U.S. news media about highly newsworthy statements made by Iranian President Mohammad Ahmadinejad. Did I say that right? On Friday, February 12th. He said the era of nuclear weapons is over, suggesting Iran has no plans to build inhumane A-bombs. Ahmadinejad called for a world free of nuclear arms in an interview with Russia's NTV channel. "We believe that not only the Middle East, but also the whole world should be free of nuclear weapons because we see such weapons as inhumane," he said. "Today, no one can use a nuclear weapon, and we believe that the U.S. is taking a wrong move by stockpiling nuclear weapons," he added. "Those who claim that they are against nuclear weapons should dismantle their nuclear weapons first to prove they are honest." So far, the libertarian-leaning antiwar.com has been the only American media outlet to cover his statements. Considering Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's call for sanctions over Iran's nuclear program, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's position that new sanctions should be crippling, one might think the U.S. media would pay attention to Ahmadinejad's statements. Instead, the media's Sarah Palin obsession means that more Americans did to start a new war with Iran in the past week. Iran has continually denied its plans to build nuclear weapons. The country's high-profile stance is that enriched uranium will be used for Tehran's medical reactor. The interview Friday was given to Russian channel NTV, once critical of all-powerful Vladimir Putin, but now controlled by the state-owned Gazprom conglomerate. CNN published a timeline of the changes to the station 9 years ago. I don't know.
I think they're trying to trick us.
Yeah. to some extent, I agree.
Hey, you people over there, get rid of all your weapons. We'll do the same thing. Oh, look. Well, we forgot about one. We're going to throw it at you now.
I don't know if I can trust a country that still allows certain treatment of my own gender, or people of my own gender.
Well, I think that if you've got some land that allows you to house a nuclear weapon safely, meaning that if it were to negligently discharge, then it would just blow up your land and not anybody else's land, then you should go for it. You should have a nuke. But since that isn't really the case, they're not such a great idea. But they are an amazing deterrent, so I don't know. It's hard to say. If you can buy a nuke, I suppose you deserve one.
Maybe we're looking at this the wrong way. Maybe it's a situation of a new couple where the guy says, "You hang up first," and the girl says, "No, you hang up first," and they go back and forth for a while until one of them finally hangs up.
For
maybe
decades.
Maybe that's what's going on. Yeah. We're this horrible love mess and waiting for the other person to finally hang up.
Wow, that's a beautiful way of explaining it. On that note, shocking report reveals the epidemic of sexual abuse in juvenile prisons. Woohoo! I'm actually not going to read this entire thing because it's quite graphic and I don't really want to read that. But more than 1 out of every 10 child prisoners in state custody are sexually abused, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. And this doesn't surprise me at all. Nearly all the incidents involve a staff member, 85%. That's really high. While the rest involve another incarcerated youth. Males are more likely to report than females. Surprisingly, a whopping 90% of all youth reporting misconduct said they had been victimized by female staff members, which is, that's not suspected, but there's in the most troubling facilities, between 20 and 30% of incarcerated youth reported abuse. It's probably much higher than that. Stunning figures have come to light thanks to the provision within the National Prison Rape Elimination Act of 2003. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I didn't know there was a Prison Rape Elimination Act of any year.
It's amazing. I think they should try to bring the drug war into the prisons too and see how that works out. I don't think that this is going to do anything, but interesting. Officially dubbed the National Survey of Youth in Custody. That sounds much nicer. The report limited its data to incidents occurring in the previous 12 months or since the youth's admission to the facility. He or she had been in custody fewer than 12 months. While nearly 93,000 people are held in juvenile detention center on any given day in the U.S., the survey does not represent those held for a short time, those held in small facilities, or young people who are held in adult facilities. So basically we already know the results of this thing, but, people get abused and raped in prisons, even young people in youth facilities, which a guy that is pretty prolific on the internet, Stefan Molyneux, refers to prisons as rape rooms, and he's probably accurate in that assessment. That's about all I have to say about that. Someone please change the subject.
I feel bad. My brother is a correction officer at a juvenile detention center.
And?
No, he's a good one.
Okay.
No, he's a good guy. The inmates tease him.
And he puts up with this good-naturedly, I hope?
No, yeah, he does. One of the inmates had a Men's Health magazine and saw my brother drinking a small thing of soy milk and hollered his last name and then said, "You looking to get man titties?" he laughed it off and he came home, and because I'm one of the few people in the family that reads anything about nutrition, he came up to me and he's like, "Can it really do that?" He's like, yeah, it can.
Wow. So. I had to drink some more.
No, he puts up with it.
I'm kind of lonely right now. I'm seriously considering it. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway.
Okay, maybe we should move on to the next story. Which,
please. I'm really hoping my laugh wasn't audible. Probably was, though. Okay.
Our next story is about milk. How about that? We managed to have a segue that wasn't forced.
Awesome.
So is this my story or Gret's?
It's yours.
Okay.
It's yours.
And I actually have not read all of the text of this. I kind of found it and said, "Hey, that's neat. I'm going to put this in the show."
Fair enough.
New rule crushes organic mega dairies and is good news for small farms. Proponents of small farms and organic watchdog groups found themselves in unfamiliar waters recently, cheering the U.S. USDA for tightening the definitions of organic meat and dairy. On February 12th, the agency passed what some are calling the most sweeping rewrite of federal organic standards since their inception in 2002. The ruling, called Access to Pasture, closes several loopholes that mega dairies have been using to exploit the organic market with milk from farms that hardly resemble the farms that inspired the now $24.6 billion organic industry. The ruling also leaves open a huge question on feeding restrictions, or lack thereof, for organic beef cows. A 60-day comment period is open until April 19th. Access to Pasture mandates organic meat and dairy cattle must graze for the entirety of the growing season, with a minimum of 120 days spent on pasture. At least 30% of total annual caloric intake must come from grazing. This is a huge blow to certain mega dairies that for years had taken advantage of the previous rule that only required organic cows to have access to pasture. This famously ambiguous phrase was often interpreted along the lines of a barn door opening to a muddy side yard. Clarifying access to pasture has been under discussion at USDA since 1994, and a rule similar to the current form was first formally introduced in 2005. Bush's USDA people managed to stall the process through a variety of tactics, some of which are currently under investigation. When the first draft was opened for public comments, 80,327 were lodged, of which 28 were in favor of clarifying the phrase access to pasture. In addition to clarifying the pasturing requirements for cattle, access to pasture tightens up several other cracks in the definition of organic. It expands and strengthens the language prohibiting antibiotics in organic feed, requires that any edible bedding, like straw or corn cobs, be certified organic, and mandates that pasture be managed as a crop, as in, to produce abundant forage. Much of the new ruling's 160 pages consist of comments on the language and content of various items. The comments are organized and discussed, with USDA offering its agreement or disagreement. Of the 26,970 comments USDA received, 26,000 were in support of more pasture time for organic cattle. All but 130 of the comments came from three modified form letters. Many were skeptical of Obama's appointment of former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack for Secretary of Agriculture. Vilsack's cozy relationship with corporate agribusiness earned him Governor of the Year by the Biotechnology Industry Organization. And this kind of goes off about a bunch of stuff about Vilsack, so I'm not going to bother with that bit. I'm going to skip down to where it says, as it stands, USDA exempts beef cattle from the requirement that 30% of nutrition comes from forage for 120 days prior to slaughter. In essence, this exemption allows organic cows to be confined and fed grain for 4 months prior to slaughter, also known as feedlot finishing. Access to Pasture observes, the sentiment among most of the commenters is that there is no place in organic agriculture for the confinement feeding of animals, nor should there be any exception for ruminant slaughter stock. If that pattern holds, writing on the wall says the organic feedlot exception should end. But if the exception is upheld and organic beef is allowed to be finished in confinement, that would not only cast doubt on what appears to be a newly inclusive and democratic USDA, it would be a blow to several key aspects of organic livestock production in Merrigan's book. Confined feeding goes against the organic tenet that animals should be allowed to express their true nature, and feeding grain to animals not only produces a different kind of meat that's much less healthy, it's also much more energy intensive and environmentally destructive. Perhaps the real discussion shouldn't even be whether or not organic steers can be confined and grain fed for the last 120 days of their lives. The discussion should be over whether organic cattle should be fed any grain at all, or should they just eat hay and straw when the grazing season ends? So, some interesting information there about the current and changing definitions of what organic means when you see it in the grocery store.
I'm so happy about this right now. I know it's kind of pathetic, but I am almost crying.
Wow.
And both of you should know how strongly I feel about food.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
This is ridiculous. I'm just happy that they're moving in a positive direction with this. People say grain, they usually think corn, but feeding oats to a dairy cow while you're milking her, just to keep her from moving around, is fairly acceptable because a handful of oats isn't going to really hurt her very much. But as far as feeding them to sustain their life and stuff like that, pasture is definitely the way to go. Provided you know what's in the pasture and nothing in it is going to hurt them. Like if they eat green alfalfa, that can kill them. Stuff like that. But this is... I'm extremely happy about this. And it makes me glad that I already knew where my milk comes from. So.
Yeah. I just thought about it kind of a different way than I normally do. And that is, I can't eat grass. So I'll let the cows eat grass, because I can eat corn, and I'd rather eat the corn. So cows can eat stuff that I can't eat, and then I'll eat the cow.
Yeah.
And I like corn and corn products, so I'd rather be eating those myself. I think that, you know, you're really... I know everybody says, you know where your food comes from, and that's, you know, an impossible task for most people to undertake, but I think that the farms that you buy, that you're buying your food from, at least should be open for you to be able to see what they're doing, and how they're growing the food that you buy, and, you know, you should be probably, you know, I don't know if there's a consumer reporting for farms, you know, like there is for other things, but idea, so people know what farms are doing what, and they can decide, you know, how they want to make their choices about eating meat or whatever else.
I agree with you about how farms should be open and stuff like that. That's one of the reasons I'm a huge supporter of family farms. And the, I believe it's a website called Local Harvest, where you can actually find and get in contact with local farms in your area. But there, depending on if you buy organic or natural products versus conventional products, a lot of companies are coming out with websites that talk about their products. And make it easier for you to understand what goes into it, even if they don't necessarily say where it comes from. I know that there's a company that raises turkey that they have all these claims on the package, but once you look up the website, they actually do say, yeah, we're local, this is how they're raised, this is what we do. And it's they're very forthcoming about it, even though they're not necessarily what most people would like to think of as that's how a turkey is being raised. At least they're being honest about it. They say, yeah, they are confined, they're kept indoors, and this is what happens, but we don't give them antibiotics unless they're actually sick and stuff like that.
Right.
So I think, you know, you brought up a good point. It's not always practical for people to know where their food comes from. It's not always possible for that. But to the extent that it is, people should know. Even if it's just getting involved with a farmer's market in the summer, or getting on the internet and looking up a company that you buy a lot from, which is, that's pretty much what I ended up doing with most of the products. So.
Good tips.
And there are more companies that are allowing tours and stuff like that too.
And watch Nomming with Grit, and you'll learn more.
Yes, we're going to record after this.
Awesome.
So, provided I'm still awake. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm thrilled about that. Honestly, it's way overdue, and it's a good thing. All right, is it my turn now? I lost track of who was reading.
Okay. I read the last story, and then we had some discussion, and now it's your turn.
Awesome. Former Mexican Foreign Prime Minister, not Mister, calls for North American Union unified currency. Prolific Mexican politician and intellectual Jorge Castaneda believes that a greater North American community, a North American Union, with economies tied together under a European Union-style system, complete with open borders and a unified currency, is the wave of the future. In a new interview with website BigThink.com, Castaneda, Mexico's foreign prime minister from 2000 to 2003 and a global distinguished professor of politics at New York University, said that with nearly 11% of Mexicans living in the United States, he has stopped seeing his nation as a Latin American country. Well, my sense is that we're moving closer and closer to forms of economic integration with the United States and Canada, and conceivably Central America and Caribbean could be part of that in the coming years. See Mexico as a Latin American country. Too much of trade, investment, tourism, immigration, remittance, absolutely everything is concentrated exclusively with the United States. So Mexico has to be part of the North American community, a North American Union, which at some point probably should include some type of monetary union along European lines, with a free flow of labor, with energy being on the table, etc. Often demonized as some type of conspiracy theory in mainstream American press, the so-called North American Union proposals have actually existed for some time. In May of 2005, the Council on Foreign Relations released a document entitled Building a North American Community, in which it calls for a UE-like integration of Canada, the United States, and Mexico. While the document does not specifically call for the ceding of sovereignty between the three nations, as some vocal opponents of the idea have suggested, it does recommend the formation of a North American Advisory Council and a multinational interparliamentary group to facilitate mutual cooperation. Though the group originally originally set out to achieve this goal by 2010, few in mainstream America are even aware of it today. The CFR's full proposal is available online. There's a lot of stuff there. Economic and social citizenship in North America implies the ability of citizens to exert pressure for the implementation of an exclusive economic policy at home and to be engaged in the international economy, wrote CFR member Carlos Heredia. To the extent that citizens of the three partner countries see that North American integration brings concrete benefits, a new constituency will be galvanized to support these efforts in the years to come. Well, I don't know. I can't bring myself to read the rest of this. It's all just, it goes on to talk about the drug war and
Yeah.
There's a lot of stupidity in this article.
I don't like it.
We don't have tiny little countries over here like they have in Europe.
I don't want the countries to merge for the simple fact that, I know this is going to be horrible, one day I would like to live in Canada and be a Canadian citizen. I might want to keep dual citizenship, I might not. I would like that option. Uh-huh. I don't necessarily want it to be, okay, you were born a citizen of this, and you're going to die a citizen of something else, but not by your choice.
Oh, yeah.
I would like to have some say in at least what I am when I die.
That's a good point. Never thought about it that way.
And I'm pretty sure Mexico's already part of North America, so his comment about that is kind of null.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Since we share a language with Canada here in the U.S.,
that's kind of,
relationship makes a lot more sense than trying to put
two countries that primarily speak English with one that primarily speaks Spanish.
Yeah.
It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And yes, I know there's a lot of people that speak French in Canada.
Well, you know, I could learn that. My sister-in-law teaches French.
You know, I heard about this way back when Alex Jones was probably the only guy talking about it. And it was a couple years ago. And they were denying that this existed in the mainstream media. Now they can't do that anymore.
No.
There's, you know, the CFR in general has had a really shady past, and a lot of interesting people have been involved with it. And I don't really like the agenda of what they do in general. You know, originally I was totally against this, and I think I still am, for just the point of view of that, you know, if we want to have, you know, more free flow of goods between countries, this is not the way to do it. We don't need more laws to tell us how to transact with each other and, you know, things like that. So, you know, I don't think borders really should have anything to do with economics necessarily. So, you know, do you see what I'm saying? I mean, like, I just think it's kind of, the whole thing is irrelevant, really, you know. And I mean, I'm against it practice, but I guess in theory, you know, I've kind of given up the whole thing about a nation being this kind of homogenous thing, instead just, you know, treat people like
people,
you know. Yeah, like people. But you know, it's hard to say, because it's like, I know that if they wanted to do this, that they would change the laws, and that would be, you know, a big incentive for them to change laws, and it probably wouldn't be in the favor of most Americans, I don't think. So that's why I'm opposed to it. But, you know, it's like, as far as, you know, having money and jobs going between here and Mexico, that seems like an issue for immigration, or, you know, something else.
Yeah, the job thing is, there are people who travel every day for their jobs, or travel weekly for their jobs. It's not uh-huh. something that's being prevented already. It's just a matter of, do you have the capacity to do it?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I don't think that, you know, products should be restricted or outlawed or anything. So, I mean, if people want to buy stuff from Mexico, that's fine with me. If they don't want to buy stuff from Mexico, that's fine with me too. Same with Canada. So, you know,
I think I bought something. I may be mistaken. Bought something from New Zealand recently. Again, I think that comes down to having the capability. But. So, should we move on to school kids?
Yes, we should.
Okay.
So whose turn is it?
I believe it's a Vogdu's. Yeah.
Vogdu, you want to take this one? It's pretty short.
Sorry about that, guys. I had somebody talking to me.
Ah.
So I'm muted. So the school gives kids laptops, spies on them via webcam. I heard Sumerian cover the show today, or this story today, on Pirate Party Radio, and I thought it was a pretty crazy story. A well-heeled Philadelphia school district gave out laptops to students and used the webcams attached to covertly spy on them both at school and at home for a new class action lawsuit. The case, Blake J. Robbins versus Lower Merion School District, was filed after one of the school's vice principals disciplined Robbins' son for improper behavior in his home, using a photo taken from the camera as evidence, according to the filing. Laptops were issued to 1,800 students at three high schools in the district, each with a built-in camera that, according to the lawsuit, administrators can activate remotely and covertly. The suit is a class action lawsuit brought on behalf of all students seeking damages for engagement in privacy, theft, private information, and unlawful interception and access of electronic information. And vice principals disciplined somebody for improper behavior in his home. I thought that was the most ridiculous part of it.
Yes.
Isn't that the parents' job?
Yes, it is.
I mean, he has no authority there. You know, it's like,
hey,
what the hell?
Principal Robbins, when did you become my dad?
Yeah, really. It's just so silly.
Instead of blame the milkman, blame the principal.
I mean, it's like, okay, so they own the laptops. They're giving the laptops to the students under certain conditions. You know, I suppose, I mean, it's twisted. It really is twisted that they'd be, you know, using their time. See, this is the weird thing. It's like they'd be using their resource, the school resources, to spy on kids while they're in their house. I mean,
that's a little perverted.
That's a little messed up.
Yeah, I was wondering if it was going to come out that the person that installed this, the software that allows them to remotely activate it, is a pedophile and is looking for.
Yeah, really.
I'm not ashamed to admit that I have a built-in webcam on my laptop. I don't really use it ever. But I'd be terrified if I found out someone was remotely activating it, because there are several times when I haven't exactly been decent in front of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard of remote exploits for a long time that people use to access webcams. So I have a webcam, but I always point it at the ceiling if I'm not using it. So.
Yeah, yeah. I actually just unplugged mine.
Screen. Yeah. I might need duct tape now.
Yeah, you might need some. So anyway,
because it's like
again,
attached to the top of the screen.
Stick take cameras and take batteries out of your cell phones and all that good stuff. I hope this guy loses his job. I guess that's all I have to say.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's absolutely asinine and inappropriate, and there are so many things could have gone wrong with this if they didn't. And I'm just wondering how many children, because these are children, how many of them were seen in inappropriate ways and it wasn't brought up? I mean, there's no excuse for this. And what the hell would they be spying on them for anyway? Making sure they're doing their homework?
It doesn't, I don't understand that at all.
Again, everything that goes on at home is under the domain of the parents.
Yeah.
And the school has no right to get involved there, unless there's proof of abuse.
Messed up.
Very messed up.
So anyway, guys, I have to head out here, but I appreciate doing the show with you guys, being able to get on here.
Yeah, and thank you for coming in and joining us.
It was fun.
It was quite fun. I hope to do it again sometime. So at least I'm going to say I do. So thanks everybody for listening, and check out Nomming with Gret. And more episodes of Rangers
and Storm the Wire.
Yes, and my show, Storm the Wire. I was going to record some new stuff with that, but I've still got footage in the can, and I've still got things to record, and so I'm a little late on the new episode, but it will be out when it's done. And my time schedule is a little bit more frequent than some other people, so even when I say when it's done, it's not like it's going to be 2 years from now. So, just letting you know.
Good to know.
So, yeah.
This is not like mine. Like, well, they show up next week, 4 months later.
Yeah. So anyway, take care, peoples.
You too.
Thanks for listening.
Yes.
Have a good one.
Take care.
Okay, and actually I have a pre-recorded outro that I can tack on to the end of this.
So, alrighty.
Unless you've got something else you want to recommend or something else you want to say.
Not that comes to the top. Ooh, kind of related, sort of, depending on how far you stretch it. If anyone gets the chance, HBO has a movie that they recently came out with called Temple Grandin, about Temple Grandin. She is an autistic woman who was born in the late 40s and rose above all of her difficulties and graduated from college, went on to be an animal behaviorist, eventually working for McDonald's. They did an extremely fabulous job, and they actually worked with her during the process of filming the movie. And she has several books out, but if anyone is interested in following up with SDA stuff and maybe a little bit more about how animals are treated, go ahead and look up Temple Grandin.
Okay. I don't get HBO, so I probably won't have a chance to do that, but...
Well, yeah.
It's always possible that it'll be released somewhere else later.
They're being sporadic with the showing of it. I haven't gotten to see the full thing, but I've seen probably 2/3. But it's very good. So that's it for me.
Okay.
That's the end of the news stories for this week. Background music for this podcast was Genesis by Walter Well off the album Exploration, available on Jamendo.com. This podcast is distributed under a Creative Commons, non-commercial, no derivatives, share alike license.